Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Story Blender. We want to welcome you, of course, hosted by author Stephen James and Jose Castillo. Tonight's show is very special guest, MJ Rose. Very excited to be able to listen to that. We also want to let you know that Suspense Radio Network and the Story Blender is brought to you by New American Library, publisher of the most provocative thriller of the year, Eeny Meeny by MJ Arledge. Lisa Gardner calls the international bestseller mesmerizing, and Tammy Hogue says white knuckles guaranteed. It's on sale now wherever books are sold. Go check out Eeny Meeny Again by MJ Arledge. We're very excited again to be able to bring you the Story Blender every other Friday night. Make sure you check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com for more information. Go to TheStoryBlender.com for more information, of course, on this show. And again, we will see you all tomorrow when we have Suspense Radio Inside Edition. Sunday is Suspense Radio One-on-One. And then Monday we are going to have Beyond the Cover with Grant Blackwood. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, because here it is, the Story Blender with very special guest MJ Rose.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Jose Castillo.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling.
Spot on as always, Steve. And for today's show, we have an amazing guest. It's been really exciting getting a chance to read up on her. And of course, Steve has a chance to talk with her multiple times. But MJ Rose grew up in New York City, mostly in the galleries of the Metropolitan Museum, the dark tunnels and lush gardens of Central Park, and reading her mother's favorite books before she was allowed, which I'm going to get back to that because I have an 11-year-old daughter who is an avid reader, so I'm curious to ask her more about that. But she's a prolific, critically acclaimed, and internationally best-selling author, more than a dozen richly crafted novels. She's also the co-president and founding member of International Thriller Writers and the founder of the first marketing company for authors, Author Buzz. She runs the blog Museum of Mysteries. We're so glad to have her, MJ Rose. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, I have to say, I am a little embarrassed about this, but whenever we meet up at Thriller Fest the last year or two, I'm always like, I got to go say hi to MJ. I walk up, hi, I'm Stephen James. And you're like, I already know you. You've introduced yourself to me like three times. I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot. So thanks for being patient with me. But
oh, no, that's okay. It's funny. Everybody thinks that I must forget them. So everybody does that. But I do remember most people, certainly you. I mean, you're a terrific writer, and you're always a Thriller Fest, and everybody speaks so highly of you.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's great. And I'll pay you when we get off the air for the compliment.
Well, MJ, for readers who aren't familiar with your novels, they really cover the gamut of mystery and suspense, of course, weaving in aspects of literary, historical fiction. What do you see as the difference between mystery and suspense?
I once read, I'm not sure who said it, that mystery is a whodunit, and suspense is a how-done-it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one explanation. The other is, like, a mystery is a very clear cut. There's a murder, who did it? And suspense is everything that isn't that.
And I was teaching about this one time, and I was talking about horror and mystery and suspense, and I was like, okay, if somebody gets their head cut off, and then everyone has to solve it, that's a mystery. If you find out someone's going to cut someone's head off and you have to stop it, that's suspense. And horror is when you see them get their head cut off.
That's great. The only thing about all those, I hate definitions and I hate categories. And the real problem with this is that there are so many things. It's one of the reasons we started International Thriller Writers, is there are so many books that don't fit into any of those categories.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Some books just have nothing to do with anybody having their head chopped off.
Right.
And could have to do with a ghost that's haunting somebody, or somebody falling in love with an FBI agent who is putting himself in terrible danger. And, you know, that's what I love about, not that this is a show about international thriller writers, but that's what I love about the organization, is that we don't ask anybody to define what they write by any set rules. If you think you're a thriller writer, then you're a thriller writer. And Lee Child once said that if a book doesn't thrill, it shouldn't be written, no matter what category it's in.
I like that. That's good. Yeah, I was at a conference one time, and this guy came up to me, and he said, yeah, I don't read too many of your books because I don't read anything in your gender. I'm like, oh, okay.
So you like, only read books written by women. Good.
Exactly.
More book sales for us.
Well, let's stay on suspense and mystery just for a second longer. Why do you think people like to be scared? Because there is that sense of, like you said, the thrill. And what is it inside of us that likes to be thrilled or scared or excited in that way?
There are two things that I've heard. One is that the world is so chaotic that we very much like to read books that we know are going to wrap everything up, and so that we can go through the ordinary experiences of our lives, which is being scared. But in the book, at the end, it's all fixed, and that there's this great satisfaction in knowing that sometimes things can be fixed. And that's one reason. And the other thing is that we learn from stories, that stories give us, not even consciously, but give us unconscious guideposts on how to live. And so being scared is, again, a natural human reaction. And then the books, I don't know. I have no idea. I'm just blabbing away here.
It sounded good for me. I was sitting there taking notes. You shouldn't have said that at the end.
I think we like to be entertained. And I don't think everybody does like to be scared. I think that, if you read love stories, it's because your form of entertainment is watching two people fall in love. And if you read thrillers, it's because your form of entertainment is being scared. I know a lot of people that don't go anywhere near, suspense novels, because that's the last thing they want, is to be scared.
I think you brought up a really good point, though, is that people want to make sense out of their lives and they want to be brought to a safe place at the end. I think that's true in most cases. I heard one author say one time, nonfiction is truth that doesn't need to make sense, and fiction are lies that do. So,
wow. Say that again.
Yeah, really.
Well, yeah, nonfiction is the truth that doesn't need to make sense because our lives don't, and so nonfiction
right.
doesn't necessarily. But fiction is lies that do need to make sense.
That's great.
Yeah, so that because we tell, not to deceive people, lies in that sense, but we tell these fictions, and if we are not believable in them, and if we don't, like you said, kind of wrap things up in a way that makes sense to people, they're usually not going to be satisfied with them.
That's great. And
yeah.
And I once also read that, you just said something and I was going to, when I was studying writing, which was a very haphazard, non-professional way that I went about doing it, but I read this great book called The Art of Fiction by John Gardner, and I've since read it many, many times. And he talks about the fictive dream, which is sort of what you're talking about, which is that it's the author's job to create this whole dream world that the reader completely is stuck in and believes in and is part of, and that the worst mistake we can do is to pull them out of that fictive dream with mistakes. And I think that we often, I was just actually reading a book, but I won't tell anybody what it was, that had a lot of what I call info dumps in it.
Yeah.
Where there's great research and the writer just can't bear to leave it out. And so they dump the information in the book. And then when I'm reading it, I'm completely brought out of the story by this long explanation of, how to paint a car. that's not it, but nobody will guess what book it was from that. so that I'm like, okay, enough already. I don't need to know how to paint the car. Just know the guy needed to paint the car, unless how he painted the car has to do with, like, how the city of Boston's going to be blown up. But that's always a problem, I think, when I'm reading. That's something that I'm very sensitive to, is some mistake that the author makes where all of a sudden I'm like, oh, wait, this is a book? I was reading another book this weekend by a woman called Sarah Allen Addison, or Sarah Addison Allen. That's terrible. I don't know which it is. It was a terrific book. It was called The Peach Keeper, and it has magical realism in it. And it's completely believable. She never makes a mistake. So I completely believed the whole book, even though things were happening that were completely impossible. And that's the sign of a really true author who can pull that off. It's Sarah Addison Allen. I just don't want anybody to think that I don't know what I'm reading.
No, that is a great point, and I'm completely the same way when I'm reading a book, if anything. And I like that. Did you call it the fictive dream? The fictive dream. Yeah. The people, yeah, anything that jars me, you know, sets me out of the story. I always want the readers, you know, when I'm writing, to be drawn in, to not even notice any of that stuff, and then all of a sudden be like, wow, I flipped to the next chapter. And anytime, and this is one of the reasons, actually, I really purposely avoid literary gimmicks like alliteration, the cat crept across the carpet, that sort of thing, whatever.
Right.
Because as soon as, you know, readers are like, oh, I can tell you went to sophomore English class in high school, right, you know. And but then what they're doing is looking for, you know, other instances where that might happen, and they're no longer in the story. They're observing it from a distant place. I actually wanted to follow up a little bit on the idea of suspense and mystery and stuff. And some people say that, you know, okay, so a little bit like sex scenes, some people like to read the sex scene as if you're watching it. Some people like the closed-door kind of romance where we know what's going on in there, but you don't have to read about it. When it comes to stories that create a sense of mystery or impending, you know, danger, suspense and stuff, what do you think is more effective, violence that we just imagine that happens like off-screen of the pages, basically, or violence that's kind of portrayed on the page?
You know, I think that has all to do with the author. I think that different authors can accomplish that equally well, depending on their talents. And I don't think I have an opinion about which actually works better. I know which one I like to read better, but I don't think that has to do with which is better. I mean, I don't read a lot of thrillers. I don't read a lot of hardcore thrillers. I read every Steve Barry book and every Lee Child book that comes out. They're really good friends. And then I read Linda Fairstein, and then it's, you know, pick and choose. But I read a lot of historical fiction and a lot of esoteric suspense. It's more like what I read, you know, like Wendy Webb and I'm trying to think of who else. Robert Goddard, and you know, it was a little bit of paranormal, but not like shape shifting stuff. I have some very specific tastes.
Yeah, that's nice.
Well, I'm curious to know, because our listeners, they're always interested in, you know, insights on how to shape better stories, whether that's through writing, oral performances, visual media. We've got, you know, folks that are telling stories in a variety of mediums. What do you think lies at the heart of a great story? What do you start with?
Well, as a writer, so you're talking about how to start as a writer. So I think that it's one of two things, and I think that either works equally well. I think you either start with a great character or you start with a great premise. And I think that's up to the individual style of the writer. I think that either way, I think a great story has to have great characters, and great characters have to have a great premise. I don't think you can write a book either way. I know that in literary fiction there are a lot of great characters that don't have great plots, and I know in thrillers there are a lot of great plots that don't have great characters. And I don't think in either category are those the best books. So there's a big debate all the time about, you know, character-driven versus plot-driven, and I personally think it's a ludicrous conversation. Because if a book doesn't have both, I don't think it can be really terrific.
Yeah, one of the things that I sometimes teach is that there are no plot-driven stories and there are no character-driven stories. There are only tension-driven stories. And it's all about characters sometimes, you know, having an unmet desire that they're trying to, you know, accomplish something, trying to reach a certain goal. And that's the tension between their search and then what they either accomplish, avoid, or obtain. So instead of trying to think, is this character-driven, is this plot, just think, what does my character want externally, relationally, internally, and just drive that tension forward. And so I agree. You know, I think it's kind of a silly thing when people start talking about character-driven, because descriptions of characters don't drive a story forward. And just
right.
like you said, you can have this all of this amazing plot, but if you don't have an intriguing character, we're going to get bored by all the chase scenes.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. I have to say, I really love your titles, by the way.
You do a great title.
And I, The Witch of Painted Sorrows, The Collector of Dying Breaths. Do you come up with these as your publisher? Because these are great titles.
Oh, thank you. No, they're my titles. Actually, the one that my publisher made me change really hurt the book. Seduction was called The Seduction of Victor H., which was about Victor Hugo. And they made me change it to Seduction, and it really hurt the book because all these people who love romance thought it was a romance novel.
Absolutely.
And they were miserably disappointed because it's anything but. And all the people that normally read me thought that I'd suddenly written a romance novel, and so they didn't buy it because they weren't interested in reading a romance novel. And as a result, it's like my worst-selling book to date. But I love coming up with titles, and I have to have the title before I start the book.
That's what I was wondering. Which came first for you?
Yeah, title always comes first, always. Sometimes they change. The Witch of Painted Sorrows was called The Secret Witch of Rue Dragon when I started, and my publisher convinced me that that would be a mistake because nobody would pronounce Rue Dragon correctly. And they'd go into the store and ask for The Witch of Rue Dragon, which nobody would understand what they were talking about anyway because it wouldn't make any sense. So I changed it.
Yeah.
The only one that I didn't write completely is, not the book, the title, is The Book of Lost Fragrances. What happened with that was I was talking to my agent, who also was a great editor, which is why I said that, Dan Conaway of Writer's House. And I was telling him the idea for this book, and I said, Cleopatra had a book of lost fragrances, and nobody knows where it is, but it had every fragrance that was created in her perfume factory. And he said, stop, that's your title. And I was like, what's my title? And he said, you said Cleopatra had a book of lost fragrances. That's the title, The Book of Lost Fragrances. So he pointed that out, and that really started this whole lyrical group of books. There are four of them so far, and there are two more coming, and I have the titles for those too, but they're not out yet, obviously.
Nice.
They're not coming.
It's really excellent, because not only do the book titles and the covers, but also your website and sort of the overall design that you've come up with really helps tell the story of how you write. Is that something that... obviously, you've had a hand in along the way. What is it that you see in your design and everything from the cover to the look and feel? How does that help you tell the story of your book and what you're trying to get across?
Well, I don't see the cover until the book is done. Mm-hmm. So I'm thrilled with covers. I love that this same artist has done the last four books, from The Book of Lost Fragrances to The Witch of Painted Sorrows. and his name is Alan Digman, and he's incredibly talented, and I'm very lucky that my publisher hires him to create these covers. But I don't get to see them before I write them. It's actually, that would be fun if I sent him the title, asked him to send me the cover before I've written the book, and then I wrote the book to his cover. That would be really cool. I'd like to do that. I need a lot of visual cues before I start writing a book, so I have a very unusual process. I buy a journal, and I spend 3 months making collages and taking notes in the journal of images that matter to the book, and just everything from pieces of ribbon to tickets to old postcards that I find on eBay. I decorate the journal. I turn into like a six-year-old in her mother's, like closet, and I
that's fantastic.
Take jewels on it sometime, and it turns into this whole crazy thing. And I call it procrastinate your way into writing a novel, because that whole 3 months, I'm reading a lot of research books, and I'm taking notes. And I'm also spending a really long time, with this journal. And then by the end of the journal, by the time I'm finished with the 3 months, I usually have an idea of what the book is about. It always changes once I start writing it, but at least I have what I need to go with.
That's amazing, because I could tell just by looking at your website, by looking at the covers, even though they're not, done before you write the book, that they're... that process was somehow part of your writing. It's really interesting to see how that plays into it. And what a great idea to come up with like a collage sketchbook. That's fun.
Thanks. Yeah, that's great. You can tell Jose comes from a marketing and brand management background.
Well, it really resonates with me that it helps tell the story of who you are and how you create what you do as well. So, and that's important for people to know if they're creating any kind of content and story that those sort of things matter. So it's well done. Looks really cool.
Thanks. Yeah, I was I studied painting. From the time I was a little kid, I wanted to be a painter, and I started taking art classes when I was 6 years old at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then I studied art all through high school, and I went to college to be a painter. So I just was never very good. So somewhere, and then I went into advertising, and I didn't actually start writing fiction till I was sort of in my 30s. So I think about the world first from a painter's point of view, and I think that's one of the things that makes my books different and makes my process different, is that I need to see this world in a way that, just in my specific way, I need to see the characters and I need to see the world. I actually have I have to find paintings or drawings of the characters, and I actually do that by looking at old paintings and drawings, and they can't be of anybody. So, like, if I find a drawing but it says the name of the person, like who it actually was, then that one's ruined.
I just saw a news story today about this this forgery, apparently, where these guys had taken a photo and said that they found this Civil War picture of this guy next to a boat. And so all these historians ever since have been trying to figure out how, where did that boat come from and what kind of steamer was it or whatever. And then the guy just like today said, no, actually it was a hoax. My buddy and I just made the whole thing up.
Oh, God.
But all these historians were like studying this for the last 30 years.
Oh,
they had
God.
This. And, so, yeah, it was interesting. And then someone else said, no, he told me he was going to sell the original photo, so maybe this is a hoax. And everything else was a double hoax coming back.
It sounds like a novel.
I know. It'd be fun to write. And I have to
actually,
say...
Actually, that could be the title of it, The Double Hoax.
Oh, that's pretty good. Now people listening... There will be like 40 submissions in the next 6 months. The publishers will be like, "What's this? I thought I just read The Double Hoax." Whenever I read a historical book, I am blown away because I don't understand how you research. I don't understand how people come. The most historical book I've ever done happened in 1994. Okay, so that's like everything is contemporary. What's the biggest secret for you to pulling that out, besides going through the old photos and just ruminating on the story for a couple of months? Do you have any, you know, insights that have helped you over the years?
I have a few. So the first one actually happened at Thriller Fest. I was doing research for my first book that had anything historical in it, which was called The Reincarnationist. And about a third of it was historical and a third of it took place in the present. And I was just fascinated with the concept of doing research and was going crazy and loving it. And there was an author there named David Eusen, and he also writes books that are a combination of present and past. And I was telling him about my process, and he'd done it a lot, so he was giving me advice. And I said to him, I've been at it for like 6 months, and I have all this research, and my only problem now is I just can't picture what the color of the shoes were that they were wearing in ancient Rome. I mean, I've seen drawings and I've seen sculpture and I know kind of what the shoes look like, but I don't know what color they were. And he said to me, neither does anybody else who's alive make it up. And it was an enormous insight. It was like, aha, I'm writing fiction. I don't have to actually know the truth about this historical thing. If I was writing nonfiction, obviously it would be totally different. But so that was one thing. And then the other thing is kind of the thing you said in the beginning is I wrote a book called The Halo Effect that had to do with I had a series about a New York City sex therapist. And this doesn't have to do with history, but it makes the point. And I did a lot of research with a therapist before I wrote the book, and I had studied to be a therapist for a while, so I knew a lot. And in the book, the therapist answers her phone during sessions with other patients because she thinks that there's a lot of insight to be gained in how a patient reacts when you answer the phone. Huh. And the therapist I studied with actually happens to do that for that reason. And I got so much hate mail from people saying, no therapist would ever do this. It's completely against the rules of therapy. Therapists don't answer the phone while you're in therapy. Mm. And I realized that, and it was totally unimportant to the story. You know, it was just like something that happened while this person was in session. And I realized that you can't, whether it's true or not, if it's going to destroy the momentum and it's not important to the story, don't make it unusual. And that's true of the historical stuff, too. It's like I've discovered things that are really strange, but if I wrote about that in the scene, it would just be terribly distracting. So I either pass over it or I alter it a little bit. But the actual trick, you know, if you want, like, factual things that I do, old newspapers and diaries from the period are incredibly helpful, and letters. And, you know, short of ancient Egypt and ancient Rome, but there's still letters and direct source material that you can read. That's been the most helpful for me, but diaries and newspaper articles are really great, especially boring ones from young women or, you know, because they're writing about stuff that I need to know, like, you know, how do they feel about walking to the train, or, you know, how boring does tea time get? I mean, that's not what I write about, but you get these tiny little details that there's no other way to get except by reading people's diaries, and that's been really helpful. Hard to find, but very helpful.
Yeah, as a geek, I have to ask this question because you have quite the technological background. You were really on the forefront of the ebook revolution all the way back in the late 90s, which is, you know, a millennium ago for ebooks. Tell us about that, publishing a book as an ebook, and you were really one of the first to do that. What was that experience like, and where are we going in the future with it?
Well, the past is easier to talk about here. It was an experiment. In 1998, I had an agent, and she'd submitted my book to several publishers who all said that they loved my writing, but they didn't know how to market a cross-genre book because it was a little bit of mystery, it was a little bit erotic, it was a little bit too literary to be commercial and too commercial to be literary. Actually, it was two books that we'd gone through this with. And she said to me, you need to write a third book and you need to make it one or the other. And I started to do that, and 60 pages in, I was like, screw this. First of all, that's not what I write. I write books like they're a mixture of things, and that's what I want to write.
Right.
And second of all, I was in advertising. I had been in advertising my whole life, and I knew how to market things, and I thought it was like completely ludicrous that publishers couldn't figure out how to market this book. So I decided that I was going to put the book online as an electronic download. There was no such thing as an e-book. The phrase had not been coined yet, actually. So I was going to put this thing online as an electronic download, or if somebody wanted a printed version, I'd go to Kinko's and I'd print it. But it wasn't that I was trying to publish the book. I was going to do these two different marketing campaigns and see which one yielded more sales. And then whichever one was better, I was going to give it to my agent, and she could take it back to these publishers and say, this is how you market her books. So I did that, but it got a little crazy, and it took off, and people started wanting the book. More people wanted the print book. I wound up printing it. I was really having fun with it, and people were buying the download, and somebody actually got a hold of the download, and it got pirated, and 3,000 copies got downloaded from the server before I caught it. And anyway, in all that time from when I decided to start it till when this happened, then the phrase existed. It was then called an e-book. And the Doubleday Book Club and Literary Guild, an editor there, had come across the book because I was selling it on Amazon. They had a program then, their first program for self-published, which authors or for any publisher, was called the Advantage Program. And anybody could sell a book through Amazon as long as you had an ISBN. And so I was selling the book through Amazon. I had a company called Lady Chatterley's Library, which is what I'd come up with to do this book. And this editor found the book at Amazon because it was the highest-ranked small press novel, erotic novel, at the time. And so Doubleday wrote me and said they wanted to buy the book for their mystery club and their erotic club. And I had to write back and say, you know, this book isn't really for sale. This is a marketing experiment, and I'm
no.
an author. And they were like, we don't care. We want it for the book club. So I sold it to them and then called my agent back, who I was mad at the time because she'd been furious with this whole plan. Publishers know what they're talking about, and if you do this, it's really self-publishing, and no one will want to have anything to do with you. And I had fired her. And then this happened with the Doubleday Book Club, and I called her up, and I said, listen, I always liked her, but I was just, you know, I said, listen, this happened, and do you want to see if any of the publishers who liked this book but didn't know how to market it want the book now? And, of course, you know, in 2 days, she sold the book to one of the publishers who had liked it but didn't know how to market it, and that was what happened. So it was very inadvertent. If I had set out to be the first person to do something, I know that I never would have come up with something that nobody had done before. It was just really an accident.
But that's amazing. I mean, the fact that you were doing A/B testing back
that's
before.
That's right. That's what I was doing.
Really, you were. That's amazing. That's a great story. I love it.
Well, that's what we did in advertising. You know,
yeah.
I mean, we test everything. Mm-hmm. So I was just doing what I'd been taught to do.
That's amazing. So now we're on the forefront of, you know, the ever-increasing wave of opportunity to put things out on technology and to share information, to tell stories. Where are we going? And again, nobody has a crystal ball, but...
Oh, yeah, I was hoping you weren't even going to get that.
Well, I'm curious to know what you think.
I was waiting to see if you would.
Yeah, are you going to start doing BC testing, or what's going to be the next thing that you're going to try with maybe one of your upcoming books? Or do you want to share that information with us? You might not want to.
No, you know... I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I don't think anybody has any idea of what's going to happen. And I wouldn't even venture a guess. Things have changed so much. In 99, when this all happened, I became the publishing reporter for Wired, and I had a column there for 4 years. And there were so many changes so fast. I mean, the one thing we all knew was as soon as e-books became, this is in 1999, we knew that as soon as, well, I guess this was 2000, as soon as e-books were under $10 and a device was under $100, they were going to take off. And that took almost 10 years to happen. I mean, I think it took 8 years or 9 years for it to happen.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, nobody does. But it's fun to see, to look back and to see how you were inventing and taking things and to the next level. That's really, really cool.
I wanted to ask just a quick question about when I watch a TV show or when I read a novel, I find it hard to turn off my, I don't know what you call it, editing voice or something, and just sit back and enjoy the story. So often I'm like, no, they shouldn't have said that. No, he wouldn't have said that. Oh, don't do that. And it's annoying. Does that ever happen to you when you're reading a book or you're watching a show or something where you just can't shut it off?
Yeah, it doesn't happen at all with TV or movies. I guess I just become a viewer, and I am not a writer anymore. I actually have the opposite problem. I have a very hard time watching or reading things as a critic. I'm a reader and a watcher first, and an author second. I guess I came to it a little late.
Oh no,
so
that's
I don't really have that problem at all when I'm watching anything. It happens to me with certain genres when I read. And it's what we were talking about. If the book isn't really well edited, I can't read it because I remember a book that I tried to read, and in the first page, they were like the word yellow was repeated like 10 times.
Oh no!
But not on purpose. It was clear that it wasn't on purpose, and I couldn't. It just really screwed me up. I just couldn't get past it. So that kind of stuff, yes, but not. I don't have that problem. Happily.
That's good. And I find, you know, when I watch a show or TV movie, it doesn't happen as much. And people ask me, well, what do you like to watch? And I'm like, I like to watch something where it takes me into a world where that gets shut off for me, where I don't even notice any of that stuff. And suddenly I'm reading a book or I'm like watching a show. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm half done with this. And I haven't heard that little voice inside of my head. And so everything that you've said about that, about drawing readers in, or I guess viewers or listeners, drawing them in and not doing anything to drive them out of the story, I think that's one of the keys to great storytelling.
Yeah, but it's so hard. I mean, I think the only way you really can do that is if you have editors, you know, have a bunch of different people that read your work before, you know, I don't think you know. One of the problems that I have, especially when I read, I mean, like this book that I'm reading now, where I was talking about learning how to paint the car, I know that the author doesn't realize that when you're reading this book, you stop on this scene and get, like, so furious that you're getting all this this manual of instruction. I know if he knew that he would take it out. So I think that's where it's important. And I run into this a lot with AuthorBuzz because AuthorBuzz is the first marketing company for authors. It's 10 years old. And I get a lot of debut authors and a lot of self-published authors come to us. And the biggest problem that I have is that, and this happens much more with self-published authors, and agents tell me this happens all the time when authors come to them too. People believe that what they've written is perfect. I mean, I do. I mean, I can't believe I can write a book. I think I'm a genius. While I'm writing it, I think it's the best thing that anybody's ever written, which is why I have to give it to other people to tell me how screwed up it is. One of the things that I talk about a lot when I teach and when I get asked advice is that writing is a very difficult thing to do because you have to be the biggest optimist in the world to believe that you have a story that's worth telling and is worth you spending a year, 2 years, 5 years writing it and all the money that it's going to take to edit it, and all the things you're going to give up having to do this, and all the things that are going to go into this, this huge sacrifice, even if it's enjoyable, it's a huge sacrifice of time and effort. So you have to be this humongous optimist. And then as soon as you're done, you have to become, you have to accept that you're going to be a total pessimist, that its reception is never going to be as great as you expected it to be, that people are going to start breaking it apart from editorial to readers, that you're going to get all these horrible Amazon reviews, God forbid you get trolls, that your publisher's never going to give it enough marketing budget or never going to give it the best cover that it deserves. I mean, the whole writing is an art and publishing is a business and a very broken business, and therein is the conundrum of how do you navigate this business, because you go from being an optimist to a pessimist and watching all these things go wrong, and then you got to do it all over again. And you got to believe all over again that you're an optimist.
And people wonder why we're so neurotic.
Yeah, we
and,
are.
You know.
We're crazy because how do you go through? I mean, I've written 15 novels, and I've gone through this with every single book, where I believe that it's terrific, and then I discover that it's really very average. And it's just a horrible process. But then, what kind of nut am I that I want to do it all over again?
I'm the same kind. Earlier you mentioned International Thriller Writers, and I did want you to tell us a little bit about that. I'm a member. I've been attending Thriller Fest now for years. I've been a member for years, and you helped kind of get it off the ground. You're one of the co-presidents today. And I would, what would you say the primary goal is, and how can joining it help authors get their stories out there to readers?
Well, the primary goal was we wanted a place for all the people who didn't belong in the other writers group, in the other writers organizations, because if they were very specific, like we were talking about before, there was the Mystery Writers of America, but you really had to write a mystery, and there's Romance Writers of America, and you really had to be a romance. And then there's International Thriller Writers, and it's anything you decide it is, and there are no dues, and it's really an amazing, you know, open-armed organization. And we started it, we have two goals. We wanted to create a camaraderie and give authors a place to, you know, exchange ideas and be with each other. And we wanted to elevate the concept of thrillers, which were the biggest genre out there, but had very little respect. And we wanted to help it gain respect. And we wanted to reward the best books in the category. And our mantra is when we innovate, when we copy, we fail, and when we innovate, we succeed. And our goal was that we wanted to help authors get more exposure for their work. That's really our number one goal. That's not true of other writers' organizations. So we're very marketing-oriented, which is not surprising considering that some of us, the original board included Lee Child and I, who are both in entertainment and marketing in our careers, other than being writers. So we very, Gail Linz and David Morrell were the two co-founders, but they were more focused on they're wanting there to be awards for thriller writers because thrillers were always cut out of the mystery writers categories. So it was awards and marketing was really the two words, and we've really done exactly that. I mean, we have amazing awards, and we do amazing things to help authors get more exposure for their books. We have the Big Thrill, which is we're the only writers organization that has a readers magazine. It's online with over 40 or 50,000 subscribers. And I probably just elevated that. It probably has like 25,000 or 30,000 subscribers. I want it to get bigger. But and we every single member of ITW who has a new book coming out gets a listing. And nobody even knows this yet, but we're starting to advertise The Big Thrill to readers in other venues. We're just going to do a year-long campaign with shelf awareness to readers where we're going to be advertising The Big Thrill to them. And we're going to start letting other people know about The Big Thrill other than people who find it. That's really exciting. And it's a really big goal because it's a very hard career right now, and we want to give authors all the help we can help give them the tools to help them find more readers.
Yeah, and I've been going, you know, for a number of years, and I've been to different conferences, and one of the things that I just have noticed is what you said, I think, camaraderie, where you don't go to Thriller Fest or you don't become a member of International Thriller Writers and feel like there's competition. Like some of the names you listed, Lee Child, Steve Barry, and some others, you know, have sold, or David Morrell, you know, Gail Lins, have sold all these books, and a lot of, you know, aspiring novelists or young novelists or whatever come in. It's like, whoa, that's Lee Child, or that's MJ, or, you know, whoever. But there is no competition. Like, all of the premier, you know, authors are just there and say, hey, I'm going to teach you everything I know about how to write a better story. I mean, how many businesses do you teach your competition every secret that you know to be successful?
That's what happens. It's so amazing. I was astonished. I have been all these years. It's been 10, 11 years since we started it. And I've been astonished. I'm the first one to say, like, all these thriller writers are so generous. And they're not only generous, but they're so nice. And we all joke around about the fact that it must be because thriller writers get all their aggressions out on the page, murdering people and killing them and kidnapping them. So when it comes to real life, they can afford to be really nice. Because I don't want to cast aspersions about writers in other categories, but I've never been to a conference or been in a group of writers where they're as nice as thriller writers. There's just no bitchiness, there's no backbiting, there's no infighting. I mean, the biggest fight we ever had at Thriller Fest was at a banquet over a seating arrangement. I mean, that's truly like the biggest, like, gossipy, oh my God, did you hear what happened? That and the fact that at the first Thriller Fest in Phoenix, Arizona, I saw two people having sex in the pool. But other than that, in the middle of the night. But other than that, that's the extent of the gossip.
I'm glad you added the caveat in the middle of the night.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, they wouldn't be doing it during the day. It was in the middle of the night. I couldn't sleep because of the time difference. And I looked out my window, and there they were. But I've never told anybody who they were.
That's probably wise. Well, we want to obviously give you a chance to talk about any upcoming projects that you have or books that have just come out, and we want to point people to obviously the best place where they can get those, whether it's your website or if you have other places you want them to look for. So what project either maybe have you just finished up, or what could readers look for?
The Witch of Painted Sorrows came out March 17th. And it's available everywhere, and it's a standalone, and it takes place in Paris during the Belle Epoque, and it has to do, I guess you could guess, with a witch, and who happens to have been a courtesan in the 16th century, and takes place in 1894 when one of her descendants comes to Paris to escape an abusive husband, and it involves art and architecture and Paris and courtesans and a little bit of witchery. And everything is at mjrose.com, which is really easy to remember. And the marketing company is called authorbuzz.com, and that's at authorbuzz.com. I mean, that's just how it's spelled. And we do everything from debut authors to giant bestsellers.
Awesome. You should also definitely follow MJ on Twitter at MJ Rose, and you have a fantastic Pinterest account. I love it. Great objects and pictures and well curated.
I spend a lot of time doing it. It's part of that journaling thing I do.
Yeah.
Where I have to really create the world of the book, and I love Pinterest. Each book has its own Pinterest page, and then there are secret Pinterest pages for each book before it comes out that I play with.
Oh,
thank you.
Now, how fun. I barely know what Pinterest is.
Don't worry, MJ. I'll explain it to him when we get off.
Well, we want to thank you for being our guest today. Great conversation. And thank everybody for listening. And, you know, ask them, spread the word, and let's improve our stories together. And you can check out my latest releases and news at stephenjames.net.
Of course, you can find out more about my latest projects at thinkjose.com. And if you want to follow a fun Instagram account, you can follow me at thinkjose.
And, of course, for more information about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you.